Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Death Vapor by Ella Scrimsour. The telephone bell rang. Sheila Grar picked up the receiver. Yes, hello? Her eyes brightened, but her voice remained cool and sedate. Mr. Stavordale Hartland? Yes. What? Oh, dear. Yes, come around at once and tell me all about it. Goodbye. Half an hour later, Mr. Hartland was ushered into Sheila's pretty little sitting room in Edinburgh. He held her outstretched hand in both his and looked hungrily into her eyes. But she deftly freed herself and sat down in an armchair by the window. Now tell me all about it, she said, motioning him to a seat opposite her. Very strange things have been happening at my sister's home, he began. First we heard curious groanings about the place, but took no notice of them, putting it down to the wind under the eaves. Then the groanings changed to terrible cries, and now peculiar vapor has manifested itself, which leaves a most unpleasant odor behind it. What is it like? I can only describe it as a volume of steam. It has appeared in all parts of the house and at all times. It hovers about for a few seconds and then disappears. I can't describe what it is, but there is something so horribly evil about it that my sister is frightened to death. Why doesn't she go away? She can't, Miss Grar. Her husband, who died quite recently, left a most eccentric will. He bequeathed all his money and property to her on one condition. And that is, that until her son marries, she spends 9 consecutive months each year at the house, Duroc Lodge. And how old is her son now? Kenneth is just 10, so of course, for his sake, she must obey the condition of the will. She knows all about you, and begged me to ask you to help her. Will you? Of course I will, said Sheila. Where's Duroc Lodge? Quite near Benderloch. I suppose you couldn't come today, he went on hesitatingly. A train leaves just after 12. Sheila looked round the room thoughtfully, and then consulted her wristwatch. Call for me with a taxi at 11:45, she said briskly. I'll be ready. Thank you so much, Miss Carrar. But with a gay little laugh, she was gone. They caught their train easily, and when they reached Duroc Lodge, Lady Morven was waiting for them. She was a matronly figure of 40, pleasant and motherly. My dear, can you help us? She cried. You are so young, so feminine. I expected a bespectacled young woman, sexless. Who would tackle the problem from a purely scientific point of view? Sheila laughed. I'm not very old, 23, she said naively. I'll do my best. A vague, dreamy look came into her eyes. I'm Highland, you know, and I have the second sight. I feel sure I can help you. Thank you, dear. And the elder woman kissed her impulsively. After lunch, Lady Morven took Sheila all over the house to make her familiar with every nook and cranny, every hole and corner in it. I don't want you to tell me any more, said Sheila. I just want you to treat me as an ordinary guest. 3 days passed, which Sheila enjoyed immensely. She played golf, rode, walked, and in the evening sang Highland folk songs. There was no sign of anything uncanny happening, and Sheila wondered if it was simply mind pictures that had been conjured up by a hypersensitive woman, and if there was really no mystery at all. It was March, and the wind was very cold, and the glow of the fire in her bedroom cheered her enormously. She curled herself up in a big armchair in front of it and prepared for a delightful read before she finally got into bed. 11 had just struck. The whole house was still. There was nothing to be heard but the rustling of the tree outside and the sharp gust of the wind. Suddenly there came the sound of a most terrible cry, a cry so full of poignant horror, of unutterable misery, of despair, that it made her blood run cold. As it died away, it seemed to leave the place even more quiet than it had been before. Sheila rose and opened her door softly. Now that her blood was stirred, she had no sense of fear. She knew she was coming to grips at last with the unknown, and every nerve in her body thrilled at the thought. The long corridor was empty, but through a circular window at the end of the moon sent her pale beams, and the scudding clouds made them appear and disappear in a weird fashion. As she stood watching and listening, Lady Morven's door opened. "Did you hear it?" she cried. "Oh, it was terrible." "Go back," said Sheila sternly. "Leave me." The door clicked, and once more Sheila was alone. Quiet as a mouse, she waited, but no cry came again to startle the stillness of the night. After a couple of hours of watchful vigil, she returned to bed and wondered in her heart if some cruel practical joke was being perpetrated by an unknown enemy. Next morning, Lady Morven greeted her guest with awestruck eyes. "You aren't afraid?" she asked curiously. "Let me watch with you," suggested Stavordale Hartland. "I don't think it is wise to leave you alone. You might have a fright that would upset you for life." "Please," said Sheila, "I came to help Lady Morven. I must do it my own way. Will you call on me if you want my help?" Sheila smiled into the earnest eyes that were watching her so closely. "I promise," she said, but she thrilled at the look of gratitude he gave her. "Oh, it's terrible," moaned Lady Morven. "I must stay here. If I do not, I lose my entire income, and everything not entailed is left to charity, so that my little son would suffer too." "Did your husband know these hauntings?" asked Sheila. "I don't see how he could have done. They only started since his death, 5 months ago." "It was an extraordinary will to make. I think it was done to feel he could tie me down, even when he was dead. It curtailed my freedom. He always hated me," she smiled. "It was a marriage de convenance, my dear, and sometimes he was really cruel to me. The only consolation I had then was little Ken." That night, as Sheila was playing the piano in the drawing room, she heard a smothered cry from Lady Morven. She looked round, and her hand involuntarily clashed on the notes, which resulted in a crashing discord. Close by the fireplace rose a misty vapor, like the steam from a kettle, but of yellowish tint, just a thin spiral column that rose from floor to ceiling and writhed and twisted in serpentine coils. Sheila rushed towards it, but even as she drew near it, it vanished from sight, leaving a slight sulphurous odor behind. Later, the dreaded cry came twice in quick succession, and even Sheila felt a cold shudder go down her spine as she heard the blood-curdling sound. But though she waited throughout the night, nothing else happened. Next day she examined the walls and floors where she had seen the mist rise, but there was nothing to account for its appearance. As she went up the stairs to her room that night, she saw the vapor at the end of the passage, and she noticed that it was in the full light of the moon's rays. "Deduction number one," she said to herself. "It must have light. Yesterday it was between the fire and the electric light. Tonight it is basking in the light of the moon." She went towards it fearlessly, but the smell was stronger and nearly stifled her. But as she reached the evil-looking column, it disappeared. For the next few days, the phenomenon was more pronounced. Almost every hour, it could be seen in some part of the house, but the baleful vapor always kept in the direct rays of some light, artificial or otherwise. Sheila's eyes grew bright. She spent nearly all her time alone rummaging around the old-world passages, investigating the little family chapel, even hunting among the ruins of the tiny priory that had once flourished was now a mere handful of bricks and stone by the rose garden. "Have you a copy of Sir John Tadson's History of Historical Scottish Houses?" she asked one day. "I think so," said Stavordale, and he went with her into the big old-fashioned library, where they discovered the musty old volume that had probably not been opened since it was first purchased in 1823. "Have you found anything out, dear?" asked Lady Morven at dinner that night. "I think so," she replied. "At any rate, I want to try an experiment. The moon will be at the full tomorrow at 9. The beams will fall right across the corridor to your door, Mr. Hartland. Now, if the death vapor appears tomorrow night, it seems within the bounds of possibility to presume it will appear where the moonbeams will fall directly on it. Don't you think so?" "Yes, of course, judging by past experience." "Well, I want you both to help me." "How?" "I will hide in the shadow of your room, Lady Morven, close to where the beams will be at their brightest. I want you to stand behind the curtain over my door and just watch. If I need any help, you will be there to give it. If not, well, I think the ghost will have been laid successfully. She wouldn't explain what she intended doing, and Stavordale felt very anxious. The little nut-brown maid had grown very dear to him, and the experiments in which she had engaged herself were none to his liking. He knew little about the occult, but he had a wholesome dread of interfering in anything supernatural. That night, at a little before 9, three human beings took up the positions allotted to them in the corridor. Gradually the moonbeams crept nearer and nearer. The night was clear. There was not a cloud in the sky, and there was only the faintest breath of wind, which hardly stirred the leaves on the trees. There was a feeling of death in the air. Sheila alone was calm and restful. In her gown of white, she looked almost like an angel. No one spoke. The stillness could be felt. Suddenly the vapor appeared, the evil vapor, which filled them all with dread. And even as they watched, they saw Sheila suddenly throw herself with a half-articulate cry at the writhing mass. Stavordale saw the dress mingled with the foggy matter, and instinctively he rushed forward. But even as he did so, there came from the vapor that terrible cry, blood-curdling, horrible, hellish. And as he reached the side of Sheila, who had fallen a crumpled heap on the floor, it disappeared. "Help me," he cried to his sister. "God, I believe she is injured." He picked up the fainting girl, carried her into his sister's boudoir, and laid her gently on the settee. Her eyes were closed, her lips blue and swollen, and there was the tiny swoon on her cheek from which blood oozed. It was like a tooth mark, and he shuddered as he saw it. "Turn the light on, fool," he cried. "Where's the brandy?" But as the electric light blazed out, he turned to his sister in horror, for Sheila was covered from head to foot in a thin slime that smelt like death. It was in glistening streaks all over her face, in glistening streaks all over her dress, a slime that was horrible, filthy, and evil-smelling. And even as he brushed her cheeks clean of the malodorous matter, he felt a burning sensation in his finger. A soft blister had risen, as though he had passed his hand through a flame. "This is awful," he cried, never heeding the growing pain in his hand. "Hillary, get Mrs. Black. Wash Sheila." Unconsciously, he used her Christian name. "Wash her in milk. I'll get a doctor. Burn all her clothes." And he gently held the icy cold hands. He had forced brandy between her tightly clenched teeth, but it had done her no good, and she still remained unconscious. Mrs. Black, the housekeeper, a Highland woman of the old school, came quickly in answer to the bell. Gently she and Hillary undressed the senseless girl and bathed her in oil and milk. "Put her in my bed," said Lady Morven. "I'll sit up with her tonight." Mrs. Black asked no questions but tended the newcomer, who was popular with everyone. With gloves on her hands, Lady Morven picked up the girl's clothing and placed it on the open fire, and as she did so there came that awful cry, as if a living creature was in pain. As the last remnant disappeared into ashes, the dreadful cry was repeated, and as it died away into an unearthly moan, a sobbing breath came from the girl on the bed. She shivered violently and opened her eyes. "It's gone," she whispered. "But oh, it burnt so." My dear," said Lady Morven brokenly, "I shall not allow you to put yourself into such danger again. I have been a very wicked woman. I shall leave here." A knock sounded. "The doctor," said Mrs. Black. The canny doctor entered. He had been told a little of what happened, but he put it all down to excessive imagination on the part of Sheila. Burnt rather badly. How did it happen?" He examined the wound at the side of her cheek. "What's this? It looks like a bite." And even as he spoke, Sheila grew whiter than before. "I'm bitten, you say? Oh, God help me," and she burst into tears. When the doctor had gone, she said to Lady Morven, "I mustn't stay. I am a danger to you all. Oh, let me go now." "My dear, don't be foolish. Of course I shan't let you go." "How do you mean you will be a danger?" "I think I have discovered what has been haunting this place. It is an elemental. Now it has tasted my blood, and it will be even more fearless. Oh, send me away. I had armed myself with a crucifix when I threw myself at it, but in my excitement I dropped it. Thus it was able to feast upon me without interruption." That night was a night of terror to them all. Even Stavordale Hartland, a man of iron nerves, felt his blood run cold at the incessant cries of horror that rang throughout the night. Sheila was almost too weak to move, but suddenly, when there had been a hush for a time, she cried out, "Beat it off. Oh, don't let it come. Get a Bible. Keep it away from me." The death vapor was materializing in the sick room. It drew nearer and nearer until it enveloped the figure on the sick bed. "Stavordale, help me, cried his sister. Together they bent over the writhing vapor, and the man placed the Bible on Sheila's breast. With a hoarse cry of rage, the vapor disappeared, but the watcher saw another tiny wound on the girl's neck. All that night they wrestled with the death vapor. The house rang with cries of rage and hate. The very rafters echoed with hoarse laughter and choking screams. When the morning came, Sheila announced her intention of getting up. "I can't rest here," she said pathetically. "I want to get out into the fresh air." Later in the day, she said, "Was there any other strange clause in your husband's will?" "No, I don't think so. Only the one relating to my staying here."
"Was that all?"
"Yes, except, of course, the crucifixes."
"What was that?"
she asked quickly.
"Oh, from time immemorial, a crucifix has hung in every room in this house. I think it's dated from the time when the monastery was dismantled, and this house was built. My husband said in his will that he wanted every crucifix in the house to be buried with him."
"I think that we may have your husband to thank for these unpleasant manifestations. It seemed wicked to accuse the dead, but I'm afraid he knew what he was doing when he made that dastardly will." After a pause, Sheila went on, "Should you die, Lady Morven, who would benefit?" A shadow passed over the face of Lady Morven. "A very distant cousin, Miss Carrar, someone my late husband at one time wanted to marry."
"Oh," said Sheila, looking sympathetically at the woman beside her. "I've been looking up the history of this place, and it makes very strange reading. Part of this house existed at the time of the monastery, and part of the foundations belonged to the time of the monastery itself. History is very vague about it, but the priory was completely dismantled in 1587. Stavordale Hartland looked perplexed. "What has this to do with the unpleasant happenings of last night, Miss Carrar?"
"A great deal. I've spent a considerable time in the library lately, Mr. Hartland, and I've discovered a lot about this place which I believe you are in ignorance of."
"Well?" "In 1539 the priory was at the height of its fame. The prior, a holy man, was beloved of all, and you can judge his horror and dismay when one day he found two of his most trusted monks offering up the Black Mass in the vault below the chapel."
"This is getting exciting," said Lady Morven. "It sounds like a novel." "The whole matter was thrashed out. It was discovered that brothers Ambrose and Aloysius were in the habit of visiting the neighboring hamlets and villages ostensibly on errands of mercy. In reality, they enticed children from their homes and inaugurated the Black Mass sacrifices. They offered the children's warm living blood to Sathanas, their chosen master, and drank it in communion."
"How shocking!"
"Justice was meted out to them by the prior. They were locked up in the vault they had profaned and left there to die a slow death of starvation."
"Still, I cannot see what all this has to do with the question in point," said Hartland. "After all, it is only a legend."
"No, that is where you are wrong. It really happened, and I believe the bones of those two unfortunates will still be found in the vault under the chapel."
"But there isn't one," said Lady Morven. "At least, I have never heard of one."
"Suppose we find there is," said Hartland. "Suppose the bones are there even. What is your theory with regard to the vapor that appears now?"
"I believe the place is haunted by an elemental."
"What is that?" asked Lady Morven.
"It is difficult to explain. It is a something that possesses an existence. It belongs to neither death nor heaven. It draws its life from humanity, or from the astral spirits it may come into contact with. I believe that in the last moments of those two monks, this elemental took possession of them. It took hold of their astral selves and lived with them even when their flesh rotted and their bones decayed. In the far-off ages, the monks and inhabitants of this place took the precaution of having crucifixes about to prevent evil spirits visiting them. That is a true origin of them being kept about this house."
Stavordale Hartland looked with interest at the frail girl who spoke so convincingly about phenomena in which, in the 20th century, it seemed almost impossible to believe.
"I believe that the elemental has inhabited this house ever since then, but by the precautions taken by the believers, its power has remained dormant, and it simply existed in a kind of trance condition in the vault below. Your husband, Lady Morven, left a will in which he ordered all the crucifixes to be taken away from this house, and you were to stay here for 9 consecutive months in a year. Soon after his death, the house became haunted. Surely the deduction is obvious."
"I think you are right, Miss Carrar. James hoped that the hauntings would occur, and either I would be frightened to death,
or I should refuse to go on living here. In either case, I should lose my income.
You have worked out a very ingenious theory, Miss Carrar, said Mr. Hartland. And knowing my late brother-in-law's particularly refined cruelty, I really believe you are right.
Then, if I put the crucifixes back, began Lady Morven, I don't think that will have much effect now. You see, the elemental has tasted my blood. It will become more venturesome. It has now a living vitality. It will, and even as she spoke, the column of vapor rose in the air, but this time it was more solid, and in the moving, writhing mass they could see the form of a face, a malignant face with eyes that gleamed and shone like sparks of living fire. It could only be called a semblance of a face, for although it possessed eyes and nose and mouth, it seemed but a shapeless mask. The most dominant feeling was the utter malignity of the creature, the almost devilish cruelty that seemed to exude from it. Quickly, Lady Morven and Hartland joined hands around Sheila, regardless of themselves. With holy book outspread, they gradually fought their way across the garden to where a deep shadow rested under a cypress tree. As they reached the darkness, under the branches, the vapor lost its shape and was once more just a thin column of mist, but an awful screaming rent the air as it disappeared from sight. "There's no time to be lost," said Sheila. "An elemental lives by light. I am safe as long as I am in the dark or in shadow. Mr. Hartland, will you motor at once to the monastery on the Oban Road? But please, don't ask questions. I want to get everything done today. Twice has the thing feasted on my blood. Already it has become fearless. Ask there if they can send the priest with holy water to bless a house, and also to come prepared to say the burial service."
"The burial service?" said Lady Morven aghast.
"Yes, yes. I'll explain all to him when he comes. Only be as quick as you can. Now, Lady Morven," she went on as soon as they had seen the car disappear around the bend, "is there anyone here who would know if there is a vault that can be opened easily in the chapel?"
"Peter Dougal, our head gamekeeper, has been on the estate for over 50 years. He was here in my father-in-law's time, and..."
"Where is he?" she asked shortly.
"At his cottage, I expect.
Let's go at once to him."
Peter Dougal, a man of 70-odd years, looked surprised when Sheila questioned him.
"Aye, indeed, ma'am, of course there's a vault. It was in 80, I think, when it was last open. The last master, ma'am, had it closed up."
"He knew of it?" breathed Lady Morven.
"Why, yes, ma'am. He always said it was an evil place, and..."
"Would it be easy to open?" asked Sheila, breaking in.
"Oh, aye. It's under the big pew in the chancel. Angus Malik and me could move the big stone easily."
"It's not sealed, then?"
"No. Just fixed in and wedged, that's a..."
"Well, open it at once," commanded Lady Morven, "and tell me as soon as it is done."
"Let us stay under the shadow of the tree," said Sheila. "We can watch for the car coming back."
"How do you know what to do?" asked Lady Morven curiously. "Have you had experiences with an elemental before?"
"No," said Sheila, laughing,
"and I don't want it again. But I've always been interested in the occult. My uncle and I were both psychic, and I remember many of the things he told me. He was always experimenting in psychic things, and of course I helped him."
The time passed all too slowly. Sheila was very excited. She knew she was in danger. Now the elemental had regained its hold in life through her. She knew that unless it was exterminated, her very existence was in danger. At length they heard the sound of the car and hurried to meet it. The priest, a jovial-looking man of middle age, was plainly mystified.
"Father," commenced Sheila, in her most winning ways, "I have a strange thing to ask you to do. You may think it is almost unorthodox, but I want you to help me lay a ghost."
The genial father looked distressed.
"Is it a joke?" he asked.
Quickly Sheila told him the story of the death vapor and the whole story, as she had learnt it.
"Now, father," she concluded, "all I want you to do is say the last prayers over the bones of those unhappy monks, if we find them in the crypt. If they are not there, then just say the burial service without a body. Afterwards, I want you to bless every room in the house."
"Poor souls," said the father gravely.
"Poor misguided men. May they rest in peace."
"They will, if you do as I ask."
"It's a strange thing you have told me, Miss Carrar, but as far as I can see, I shall be doing no harm by acceding to your request, and I may be doing a great deal of good. Where is the vault?"
"We'll go there in a minute, Lady Morven. Can you find me 2 very long steel knitting needles and a spirit stove? Mr. Hartland, will you get some lamps, as I expect the vault will be dark?"
When everything was ready, they entered the tiny chapel. "You are sure you all want to come?" asked Sheila.
Something very horrible may happen down there. Are you willing to risk it?" Without a word, Hartland began to descend the steps that led to the crypt below. They found it was quite small and very musty. They hadn't far to look for that which they sought. In one corner, on the earthy floor, were some human remains. Two skeletons lay close together, their bony arms embracing, as if in their last moments of agony they had drawn near to each other for sympathy. Their bones were white, and every scrap of flesh had long since disappeared. Sheila examined the skeletons closely and gave a cry. "It's as I thought. Look," she said. And there in the bony frames remained the hearts, slightly withered and parchment-like, it is true, but retaining the shape and appearance of living flesh. "I've never seen such an extraordinary thing," said Stavordale Hartland. "Those hearts look as if there is life in them still, and yet the bodies must have been dead for nearly 400 years. "That explains what I meant," said Sheila. "Those monks have never really died, in the full sense of the word. Their flesh rotted and their bones are now like powder, but in the moment of their last agony the elemental enveloped them and took its life from them. There," pointing to the two hearts, "there is the very existence of the elemental. It is that I am hoping to destroy." Stavordale bent forward with his hand outstretched to touch them. Don't, cried Sheila, but she was too late. The soft, yielding flesh, still warm, filled with blood, burnt him, not with the pain of fire, but as if he had touched some foul corrosive acid. "Let us begin," said the priest. "I don't like this dabbling in the unknown. The whole thing savors too much of witchcraft." He lifted a crucifix on high and got out his breviary. Slowly he droned the Latin prayers. Sheila stood close to the skeletons with her needles, already made red-hot in the little stove. Her nerves were all on edge. She was waiting. Suddenly the watchers became aware of a little shuddering sigh that seemed to rise from the very hearts themselves. It grew in volume until the whole place reverberated with a strange ghostly sound. Still the priest droned on. Lady Morven drew nearer to her brother, and he put a protecting arm about her. Then the skeletons became enveloped in the thick grayish vapor that had for so long terrified the inhabitants of Duroc Lodge. It was faint at first, but it grew stronger and stronger, until it had once more assumed its malignant shape, a shape that had no definite outline, but yet seemed half-human. The hideous face peered at Sheila. It was a grinning, cruel, demoniacal face. It grew plainer, the body had formed. There was a semblance of arms and legs. "Quick, father," breathed Sheila. The priest never looked up, but his words tumbled over each other in his eagerness to finish. The bones were sprinkled with holy water, and at that moment Sheila plunged the red-hot needles into the soft, yielding hearts. Hearts of men who had been dead for centuries, yet still retained a semblance of life. There was a smell of burning flesh, and a dismal howl came from the elemental, as if enfolded Sheila in its deadly embrace. But she was fortified, and it had lost its power. The whole place echoed with wild laughter, with yells of rage, and even as the skeletons fell to pieces, the death vapor grew fainter and vanished from sight. For a few seconds, smothered screams rent the air, then they too died away, and the whole place was plunged in silence once more. They all bent over the poor bones. The hearts had crumbled into a powdery dust. The bones were no longer whole. No longer was there anything evil about them. They seemed to breathe peace. Silently, the little party made their way back to the chapel above. A silent group. The priest was the first to speak. "Why? Who are those?" he asked in amazement. Hartland and Lady Morven saw nothing, but Sheila put her arms on his. "The souls you have set free, father," she said softly, for she also saw two figures with shaven heads and habits of brown, girdles of rope about their waists, kneeling with bowed heads before the altar. "Requiescant in pace," murmured the priest, and even as he spoke, a brilliant light surrounded them. They held out their arms in supplication and disappeared. The Room of Fear by Ella Scrimsour. Menzies Castle was a house of mourning. Sir John Bavary, delightful guest and most companionable of friends, was dead. Molly, Lady Menzies, the youthful chatelaine of the historic house, was red-eyed with weeping as she flung herself into her husband's arms. "Archie, I shall go mad if we stay here another day. It's too awful." Lord Menzies smoothed his wife's hair and fondled her tenderly. He was a gaunt man of 40-odd years, and his young wife was the apple of his eye. "Little one, don't worry," he said quietly. "It's just a coincidence. You heard what the doctor said. Sir John died of heart failure and—" "Yes," she broke in. but so did Tom Escort, Tom, who was never ill in his life, and then Rosa Mullenden. No one could deny that Rosa was healthy enough, yet she died. And now dear old Sir John, I'm sure the tower room is haunted. My dear Molly, you must not give in to such fancies. We live in the 20th century, and rooms and places aren't haunted now. The tower room is perfectly safe. It is only an extraordinary coincidence that on the three occasions it has been used as a bedchamber, its occupants have died of heart failure. But little Molly Menzies shook her head. She still believed in the uncanny. Look here, he said at last. I'll sleep there myself one day soon. You shall see. I will be quite all right. No, no, cried his wife. You mustn't. I'm so afraid, Archie. A bell clanged through the great hall. A second later, the butler announced Miss Sheila Carrar. Lord Menzies smiled. All right, little girl. See your psychic detective. She has evidently agreed to take your case up for you. Sheila came forward quickly. I was so sorry to hear of your trouble, Lady Menzies, and I do hope I shall be able to help you. You don't know how thankful I was to hear you were staying with Lady Morven, Miss Carrar. She told me how wonderful you were over that peculiar affair at Duroc Lodge, and so I telephoned through on chance. And as it was only a matter of 15 miles, I motored here at once, finished Sheila with a smile. My husband, Miss Carrar. Now you must go, Archie. I can't possibly talk in front of you. You don't know how horribly material he is, Miss Carrar. As soon as the two women were alone, Lady Menzies began. There isn't a great deal to tell, she said thoughtfully. I will show you over the castle later on. The tower room is the oldest part of it and dates from the 10th century. There were originally 4 stories to it. Now nothing is left but the tower room itself, which is built on a higher level than the rest of the castle. Underneath it are cellars, which were originally used as kitchens, I believe. The room was closed up in my husband's grandfather's time. It was supposed to be damp. About 2 years ago, the Earl had the door reopened, and the room furnished as a studio for me. The light is excellent there for painting. That is my great hobby, you know. Well, said Sheila interestedly, well, there is no more to tell. I used the room constantly with no ill effect. A year ago, this very month, we had the entire West Wing redecorated. There was a small house party here at the time, and I was rather pushed for room. I had the tower room fitted up as a bedroom for a distant cousin of mine. Her voice broke slightly. I had known Tom Escort all my life. He was a sailor, a jolly light-hearted fellow that nothing could upset. He slept in that room for 3 nights. He never complained about anything. On the 4th, he was found dead in bed. It was just heart failure, the doctor said. A few weeks later, Rosa Mullenden came to stay with me. She had been engaged to Tom and expressed a desire to occupy the same room in which he died. We tried to dissuade her, but she urged us to give in to her wishes. She was broken-hearted over his death. I went in to her at 11. She was quite happy reading a book of his that had never been removed. Next morning, she was dead. Everyone thought it was just a coincidence, and when the ceiling fell down in Sir John's bedroom, it was suggested he was sleeping in the tower room. He knew of the deaths of Tom and Rosa, and always laughed at me when I said that some uncanny influence must be at work. I told him there was plenty of room, and there was not the slightest necessity to use that horrible room, but he insisted. That was last night. He was as merry as could be, and made arrangements to be called earlier this morning, as he had arranged to play 9 holes of golf with the minister before breakfast. When his man went in to call him, he was dead, had been dead for some hours. Dr. Brown was sent for at once, and certified as before heart failure. He seemed dissatisfied with his own diagnosis, however, and phoned to Tenui for Dr. Andrew, and to Oban for Professor Wymas. They arrived an hour ago and corroborated his verdict. Just heart failure with no complications. But I am not satisfied, Miss Carrar. But it seems a very straightforward story, says Sheila. So far it is strange that 3 deaths should have taken place there, but you say you used the room constantly as a studio with no ill effects. Lady Menzies held out her hands pathetically. That's the story, she said. Sir John's relatives are very anxious that his body should be taken to England to his home there. It will leave by the night express tomorrow, so you can commence your investigation the day after. Meanwhile, the house is too sad to offer much entertainment. Sir John was very popular, you know. Please, don't bother about me, said Sheila. If you will let me go to my room, I shall be quite happy with a book. Most of my guests left considerately this morning," went on Molly, "and by lunch tomorrow the last one will have gone. So there'll be a quiet house in which you can work. I'll take you to your room. We dine at 7. When Sheila was alone, she sat at her open window and drank in the balmy air. Her life was altered by the merest chance. So far she had been successful. Would she continue so? On the following evening the minister held a brief service in the darkened death chamber, and then the coffin was carried on stalwart shoulders to the ferry, where it was taken across the loch to the nearest station, Tainuit. The castle was empty at last. Sheila's only guest. It was with mixed feelings she entered the tower room. In her heart she hoped that if some sinister influence was at work, she would be able to discover it. But on the whole she felt rather skeptical, and thought Lady Menzies was distressing herself over nothing. There was certainly nothing ghostly about the tower room. It was a long apartment with a circular alcove at one end, lighted as well by large windows on either side. In the alcove was a glass door which led down a short flight of steps to the garden and the cellars below. A huge stone hearth with massive brass dogs was built corner-wise across the room, which added considerably to its picturesque appearance. There was neither cupboard nor recess, and nowhere where anyone could hide. Lady Menzies led the way down to the cellars. There was nothing even gloomy about these. They were lit by electricity, and the sandy floor was dry and clean. Both the tower room and the vault seemed above reproach. "I'll stay here all night," announced Sheila, once they were in the tower room. "No, no," gasped Lady Menzies. "I'm not sure it's safe. I couldn't allow it." "Nonsense," said, smiled Sheila. "If I am to investigate, I must stay here. Now, please, don't worry. I promise you I shall be quite all right. Oh, there is a bell. Is it in working order?" And she pulled an old-fashioned bell cord. Immediately there clanged out a cracked and plaintive cry, and a maid came scared into the room. "It's all right, Sanders," said Lady Menzies. "Miss Carrar was trying the bell." "Now," said Sheila, "if anything happens, I'll peel the bell, and you can send someone into me." It was not without misgivings that Lady Menzies left her in the ill-fated room that night. But she was very cheerful. The lights were full on, and the fire burnt merrily, and as Lady Menzies shut the door after her, Sheila heard the muffled tones of the big grandfather clock outside strike 11. She had really no preparations to make. She had no plan of campaign, for she didn't know what she was waiting for, what she expected even. However, she drew a chair close to the blazing fire and began to read. The book was rather dull, and she dozed over it. The fire burned low, and suddenly she awoke with a start. The grandfather clock outside chimed the 3 quarters. It must be 1:45. She had been asleep nearly an hour. She stretched her arms in delicious contentment. Her mouth was wide open in a yawn, but even as the last silvery notes died away in the silence, she became conscious of fear. Fear of something intangible, and she realized she was shivering from head to foot. With an effort, she relaxed her muscles, and her arms fell to her sides. But the effort left her weak and trembling. Her mouth was stiff with horror, and she closed it with a jerk. She looked around the room. There was nothing to be seen. The lights shone steadily, and a faint glow came from the fast-dying embers. Suddenly her knees gave way under her, and she sank exhausted to the floor. The grandfather clock chimed again, and in a mellow tone proclaimed the 1:01. For 15 minutes she had lain upon the floor in an uncontrollable fit of fear. She tried to reason with herself, but could scarcely command her thoughts. She was only conscious of one thing, one sensation, terror. A blind terror that was all the more hideous, and its source was nameless. There was no unreal quiet about the room, no ghostly calm. There was no strange light to be seen or unaccustomed cry to be heard. Everything was quite natural. There was absolutely nothing to account for her nervous state. She managed to raise herself on one elbow, and was shocked to find the sweat pouring off her forehead, while her heart pumped painfully. She dragged herself to her chair and fell back exhausted into it. As the minutes passed, so her terror increased until she felt suffocated. The grandfather clock chimed with monotonous regularity and presently struck 2. 1:15 had passed. Sheila felt powerless to move. The minutes were the most awful in her life. The fire burnt lower, still under the embers of wood, became white and lifeless. Again and again the silvery chimes rent the air, but the girl was as if under a spell and remained motionless, her eyes glazed with terror, her face white and drawn, and her limbs quaking. 3:00, 4:00. Already the gray dawn was creeping in through the curtain windows, and the birds had commenced their morning song. As the last stroke of four died away, the nauseating pall that had hung over Sheila, like an unwholesome garment, lifted. She became aware of a sense of relief. Her limbs ceased trembling. She was weak, it was true, but she was clothed once more in her right mind. Tired and worn out with her vigil of terror, she flung herself on the bed and drew the eiderdown about her cold shoulders. At 8, tea was brought to her by a frightened maid, who feared what she might find in that room of tragedy. But Sheila was sleeping peacefully, and there was no hint of mystery or horror. She awoke lazily and drank her tea greedily. She was tired and very thirsty. She looked around the room, and gradually the night's events unfolded themselves to her sleepy brain. She remembered the unholy terror she had suffered. From 1:45 until 4, she had been within its awful grasp. She had suffered the torture of the damned, yet there was nothing to account for it. She dressed slowly and thought deeply. Yes, there must be something wrong with the room. She knew now that the doctor's verdict of heart failure was correct. The inmates had died of heart failure brought on by fear. But fear of what? She tapped the walls. They were all solid stone and gave out no hollow sound. She looked up the chimney. It was a very old-fashioned one, and she could see the glimmer of light beyond the gloom. It was a very puzzled Sheila that appeared at breakfast. Lady Menzies looked at her anxiously. "How did you sleep?" she asked. "When I got to bed, very well indeed. But I sat up rather late. I feel tired this morning." "You saw nothing, heard nothing?" "Nothing." Her hostess seemed relieved and spent the day with Sheila in the open air, then a round of golf, and in the afternoon explored the glens and woods. The second night she sat up as before. Again the room had no perceptible change, but as the last sound of the clock chiming the 1:45 broke the stillness, the same terror came over her. This time the fear was more intense. She experienced her old childish fears of the dark, but they were intensified 1,000-fold. She was horribly frightened. She crouched down in a corner of the room as if waiting for some terrible doom. Her heart beat painfully. Her throat was parched. Her lips cracked. She tried to remonstrate with herself for her stupidity, but the ever-present feeling of terror overwhelmed her. Her head was bent as if waiting for a blow. She anticipated the hideousness of pain. Her wonderful willpower was hardly strong enough to help her in her fears, and as she involuntarily gave way to them, her suffering were more acute than before. She made one more effort to reach the door, but her limbs refused to work, and she sank lower, muttering incoherent gibberings. Time passed. She had lost the sense of where she was. Dimly she heard 4 silvery notes, 4 o'clock, and, as if by magic, the fear left her. This time she felt weaker than on the previous night. When the maid called her in the morning, she was flushed and feverish, and said she would have her breakfast in bed. Lady Menzies came to see her and realized at once that something had happened. Sheila, however, refused to tell her anything, and only announced that she intended going on with her investigations. 3 more nights passed, but the strain was growing too much for the girl. She grew to dread the days because they would lead to the nights. She dreaded the nights and longed for days to dawn. Every night, as regularly as clockwork, as soon as the clock chimed 1:45, the feeling of terror claimed her, and for hours she was in its cold embrace. She was very reticent about her discovery, but Lady Menzies felt alarm as she saw the roses fading from her cheeks and the deep shadows under her eyes growing darker day by day. The mystery remained unsolved. Try as she might, she could discover no reason for the paroxysms that oppressed her. One day she asked Lady Menzies to send for Robert Moffat, a well-known chemical analyst of Glasgow. Carefully examined the room, but could find not the slightest sign of poison or noxious gas concealed in the wallpapers or furniture. After a long examination, he announced that there was absolutely nothing the matter with the room at all. Then they brought an architect in to see if he could discover any secret chamber leading from the tower room, but his examination only proved that the walls were quite solid. 1 fortnight passed, and Sheila had become very nervy and restless. The nightly torment she went through was beginning to undermine her constitution. Each night left her weaker than the previous one. She began to suffer from palpitations of the heart and experienced great pain when she breathed. "I won't give in," she said to herself. Between tightly clenched teeth, "I will master this stupid terror." Although the fear was still tangible, it had become more real. She suffered acute physical pain at times. It varied in intensity, but always sensitive to the slightest scratch. Her sufferings at times were almost unbearable. Then came the night when her whole body felt as if it were on the rack. Her joints cracked, her muscles swelled, and when she awoke in the morning, her arms were inflamed and sore. She felt the time had come to speak of the terror she was going through. Lord Menzies looked grave. If there's anything supernatural at work, don't you think it would be wiser if I'd had the door blocked up again? The room needn't be used, and I think it would be wiser for you to give up this search. No, said Sheila defiantly. I'm determined to get to the bottom of this mystery. I wonder if you would have the room entirely redecorated.
Why, certainly, if you think it will make any difference.
And the chimney swept?
Certainly.
The orders were given, and for a week Sheila slept in peace, and to some extent recovered her nerve. When the room was finished, Sheila again insisted on sleeping there. But the horror was worse, if anything, than it was before. She felt the cold sweat running down her body. Her hands were clammy and cold, and as the clock outside struck three, she realized she could no longer stand the strain. She dragged herself across the floor to the bell pull. Unconsciously, her lips moved. "Stavordale, Stavordale, help me," she cried. A harsh bell clanged through the oaken corridors with startling suddenness. Lady Menzies stirred uneasily and then woke to life.
"Archie, it's Miss Carrar. She's in danger," she cried. "Quickly, quickly."
But the servants were before her, and when she reached the tower room, she was being carried out. She was quite stiff, her eyes were closed, and her breath came in short, convulsive gasps. Tenderly she was placed on a settee, and brandy was forced between her tightly clenched teeth. She moaned slightly and opened her eyes, and then fell into a rather restless sleep. Lady Menzies watched by her side through the rest of the night, and in the morning, although she was much better, a doctor was sent for. "Heart trouble," he said quickly, when he first glanced at her, but after examination, "very strange. She shows every sign of having a badly strained heart. Yet it is working quite normally now. I should say she has had some great shock. Plenty of rest and quiet, a light diet, and she'll be quite all right in a couple of days." About 10, Stavordale Hartland came over in a great state of excitement.
"Sheila, Miss Carrar," he asked, "is she ill?"
"Why, how did you know?" asked Lady Menzies in some surprise. "She is certainly not very well. She fainted last night, but there's not the slightest cause for alarm."
Stavordale's face whitened.
"It's damnable," he cried. "I beg your pardon, Lady Menzies, but it really is. It's perfectly mad of a child like Sheila to meddle with the unknown. When may I see her?" he asked eagerly.
"Tomorrow. She'll be quite herself, I hope."
Next morning, Stavordale arrived with an armful of flowers for Sheila. She smiled shyly as she took them.
"How did you know I was ill?" she asked.
"You told me yourself," he said grimly.
"I did?" she asked in some astonishment.
"Yes. I awoke and heard you calling me. 'Stavordale, Stavordale, help me,' you seemed to say. Oh, so distinctly that I thought for the moment you were still with us in the house. The horror in your voice nearly maddened me. I knew something was wrong."
"Little girl," he went on hoarsely, "if you called for me in distress, surely it proves you think of me sometimes. Won't you give up all this and be my wife?"
"Oh, I can't," she cried tremulously. I can't. I have a mission to fulfill. I can't explain. If you'll only be patient. Will you send for me if you ever want my help?" he pleaded. "I promise you I will be patient. I won't worry you any more." "If I ever need any help, I will send for you," she said sweetly, and he had to be content with that. "I'm going to stay in the cellars under the tower room," announced Sheila a few days later. In vain they threatened, forbade, commanded. "Won't you let someone watch with you?" pleaded Lady Menzies, but she refused to help. At 11 she went down and turned the lights on full. It was rather chilly, and she buttoned up her coat and drew a rug around her shoulders. The hours passed slowly. 1, 2, 3, 4. At 7 she went to her own room and slept peacefully until late in the morning. The next night found her in the cellar again, but nothing disturbed her tranquility. The cellars were obviously immune from the phenomena that haunted the upper chamber. In desperation, she fulfilled her promise to Stavordale and sent for him. "I can't fathom this at all," she said. "I wonder if you and Lord Menzies would sit up with me tonight in the tower room. I want to see if the same fear will affect you both." That night there were three watchers. It was very still, and there was a pleasant smell of cigar smoke in the room. They talked on all subjects but one. Psychology was taboo. Lord Menzies was in the midst of a funny story when the clock chimed the 1:15. He stopped in the middle of a word, his face whitened, and he stared at Sheila out of glassy eyes. Stavordale moved restlessly. Sheila had lost consciousness. Fear the omnipotent held her within its thrall. Lord Menzies staggered to his feet and gasped in unnatural tones.
"I'm stifling. Let's get out of this accursed place."
It took the united effort of the three to force themselves out of the room. They staggered, supported each other, staggered again, and eventually reached the door. The sweat was running down the two men's faces
and it was with a sigh of relief that they closed the door behind them. But as they reached the passage, the terror left them.
"This is the end," said Lord Menzies dryly. "You don't sleep there again, young lady. Tomorrow I will have the door bricked up. Why, it's worse than uncanny. It's unholy."
Next day Sheila went to the tower room. She was very disappointed. All the suffering she had gone through had been for naught. She had not discovered the sinister secret of the room. Already the furniture was gone, and the carpet had been taken away. The sunlight streamed in, and its beams strayed into the passage beyond. Almost without thinking, she noticed the difference in the flooring. Out in the passage it was black and shining, slightly rough and uneven in places. In the tower room itself, the floor was more even, newer, smoother. "I wonder," she said to herself, and went in search of the Earl. "Before the door is bricked up," she said abruptly, "I wonder if you would try and pry up some of the flooring in the tower room."
"Why?" he asked.
"I was just looking at it now, and the floor looks altogether newer than that outside. Surely if the tower is the oldest part of the castle, and the original flooring is in the passage, the tower room ought to have the older boards."
"Start at the door," she directed. "One of the boards looks quite loose there."
With great difficulty he succeeded in raising one of the narrow boards. Eagerly they peered underneath. A wooden step, black with age, worm-eaten and uneven, met their astonished gaze. He pried open a second and a third board, and three more steps were laid bare before them. "This room was on a lower level at one time," said Sheila in excitement. "Or the floors have all been taken up, Lord Menzies." With the help of some of the outdoor servants, the whole of the flooring was removed, and the original floor was open to view, some 3.5 feet below. Three stairs led down to it from the other portions of the house. Sheila gazed at it uncomprehendingly. It was a very rough, uneven floor. Great knots were in the wood, and in parts it was very frail. Here and there iron rings and rusty bolts were fixed to the ground. In one corner an iron slab was raised perhaps a foot from the ground. On the slab itself were fastened metal sockets in the shape of a boot. Sheila gazed at them curiously and slipped her little feet into them.
"Whatever are they for?" she asked,
and suddenly gave a cry of pain. "Oh, help me, Lord Menzies. I can't get out. Something is hurting me."
The Earl bent over her. A rusty catch on one side still worked, and he opened the boot-shaped metal. Inside were sharp iron spikes that fell into position when the foot was slipped into the boot. But they were so cunningly fixed that they would not allow the feet to come out again, and the slightest movement gave the most excruciating pain. She was scared. "What is it?" she asked.
"Torture," he breathed. He picked up an old and rusty pair of thumbscrews.
"A torture chamber," he repeated. "And I should say one of the most horrible of its kind. Yet I have never heard of it. Who used it? Whether it was civil or religious, I don't know. It must have been complete in its terrors."
Bloodstains on the floor had turned brown and rusty, but they were ominous reminders of the horrors of bygone days. In one corner lay a spiked iron club, rusted with blood. There was a rack fixed to the floor itself. Chains, clubs, iron masks with bloody spikes inside. The room was completely equipped for its dreadful purpose.
"It's horrible," said Sheila, shuddering. "I wonder I didn't think of the solution myself. This was a torture chamber and probably always used at the dead of night."
"From about 1:45 until 4 o'clock," put in Lord Menzies.
"Yes, it would be the most unlikely time for discovery. It was no doubt entirely secret. That is the reason you have no records of its existence. You see," she went on excitedly, "the hideous fear of the unhappy victims communicated itself to the very room. The walls, the wood, the bricks were impregnated with wave upon wave of terror from the suffering ones. They retained it throughout the ages, and each night the terror that was once inflicted here is let loose again at the hour it used to take place."
"But is such a thing possible?" asked the Earl.
Sheila smiled. "It seems like it, doesn't it? What other explanation can you give? At any rate, I suggest that you have the old floor taken away altogether.
Well,
have the cavity between the old and new floors filled in and destroy," pointing with shudder, "these.
And you think that the room will be all right then?"
"I don't know. It seems possible."
"You will stay till it is all complete," urged Lady Menzies.
"With pleasure."
The work was set in motion at once. In the course of excavations, the workmen discovered a charred skeleton. The fingers were gone, and the way the bones were twisted proved only too plainly the pain that the unhappy creature must have suffered. "May it rest in peace," said Laid Menzies, and he gave orders for its burial. The hideous belts and torture instruments the Earl caused to be thrown into the loch. He never found any records of the terrible place. He searched his own family histories, but never a sign or clue was given to point to its existence. Sheila, Lord Menzies, and Stavordale Hartland stayed in the room the first night that the floor had been relaid. At 1:45 they all became nervous, but the night passed with no ill effects. Clearly the room of fear no longer justified its name. The intangible horrors of the past had gone. The sounds of agony, the horror and terror, the awe-inspiring spectacles that had been absorbed into the very room itself and that were nightly exuded from had gone never to return. The torture chamber was no more. It was early September when Sheila once more boarded a train en route for Edinburgh. Stavordale Hartland saw her off from Benderloch. She had stayed a couple of nights at Durock Lodge after leaving Menzies Castle. As the guard waved his flag, Stavordale drew towards her, and instinctively their lips met. The whistle blew, and Sheila, blushing rosy red, slipped back into her corner seat, trembling with happiness. Stavordale Hartland watched the train fade away in the distance. What mattered that no smiling face leant out of the window and waved him a farewell? He pictured the rosy face in the corner, the tremulous lips, the downcast eyes. He was well content.